Howdy, Sparksadillos, and happy Record Store Day 2024. Sparks has issued two releases for today on freshly pressed vinyl. A 45th anniversary re-release of that Mount Kilimanjaro of Sparks albums, Number One in Heaven, and, deep breath, a long-awaited reissue of Is There More to Life Than Dancing by the ephemeral pop vocalist Noel. Full name, we think, Patricia A. Noel. Sparks diehards will recall that the Noel album was fully the brainchild of Ron and Russ. Recorded in Los Angeles in the spring of 1979, Ron and Russ sought to take the lessons recently learned from Giorgio Moroder and apply them to a new project without any input from Giorgio. Perhaps even without the use of a studio, which housed massive, costly, modular synthesizers that were not that easy to come by in 1979. I'm a fan of the Noel album, and I'm both pleased and surprised that Sparks has finally acknowledged how good it is, and that it's an important piece of the overall Sparks canon. We did a whole episode on the Is There More to Life Than Dancing LP. That was episode 27, and if you want to know more about this utterly unique Sparks adjacent record, you should check that out. This is episode 43. I'm joined today by our very good friend Monty Mallon and a very special guest coming to us from Leeds in the UK. He's such a hardcore Sparks head, he's DJed a few of their fan conventions in the UK. He goes by Ad Rebirth, and he's got some valuable thoughts and theories about Number One in Heaven and a bit about the Noel album as well. I'd like to share with you some of Ad's words he sent to us before we recorded the episode. Being a child of the 90s dance music explosion, I have particular interest in Sparks' unique relationship with, quote, music that you can dance to, end quote, that in some ways has stretched back to the earliest days, but maybe reached its pinnacle with Number One in Heaven. As such, if you wanted a discussion about Sparks' contribution to electronic dance music, particularly with regard to this album, I'd love to oblige. I have a few talking points you may wish to discuss. How Number One in Heaven is a defining statement, a manifesto that in so many ways writes the playbook for the dance music of the future and the male's uneasy love-hate relationship with it, sometimes seeming to mock the very style of music they're choosing to make. Although Giorgio Moroder rightfully gets credit for his technical and musical wizardry, I can make the case that while he might have twiddled most of the knobs, it was the males who chronicled and expatiated on what dance music is all about philosophically and sociologically, its context in the wider world, how, in a sense, Sparks saw the eternal, fundamental human need for dancing that would far outlive the ephemera of the disco fad. Indeed, they helped move the very idea of dance music beyond the confines of the disco scene, transforming it into something brand new. The three of us had ourselves a right jolly old chinwag celebrating these two new re-releases, as well as Sparks and Sparks fandom in general. Don't forget, by the way, to check out Monty's YouTube series, Sparks Entertainment and Art. He's already got some 15 or so episodes under his belt, and I really enjoy hearing from the different types of Sparks fans Monty has had on his show. While we're at it, although he's not present with us on this episode, I also highly recommend Meta Sparks on YouTube. That's Paul Barrett's show, with fascinating and original theories about the music of Sparks and how it relates to the music of Sparks. And now, is there more to life than dancing is dangerous? God damn it. Hey, everybody, Sparks fans. This is All You Ever Think About is Sparks. I'm your host, Christian Huey. We have a returning good friend, very often co-host, Mr. Monty Mallon. Good to see you again.
Glad to be here again.
Excellent. And if it's been a while since you, as a listener, have checked into what we're up to, Monty's YouTube channel/show Sparks is entertainment and art, or art and entertainment? I always get them confused.
Sparks Entertainment and Art.
Entertainment and art. That's right. And you've now released what, 9, 10 episodes or so?
We're going to be releasing, I think, 15, number 15, a week from the day that we're recording this. And this one will be probably number 16.
Beautiful. Okay, great. So we can do some fun cross promotion, because this will be your next episode and mine as well. And we are also joined from across the pond, Mr. Do you go by Adam or Ad?
Either will do, but let's say Ad.
We have Adam/Ad Rebirth with us from Leeds.
Well, I live in Leeds, and I believe, Monty, you had a guest from Leeds University a couple of episodes ago when you were talking about Sparks and neurodivergence. So I'm actually just down the road from Leeds University, but I'm actually originally from down near London, the other end of the country, down near, between Brighton and London. So yes, I moved up here 200 miles away, and that's where I am right now.
All right. Well, thanks for being on the show/shows. So the focus of this episode is going to be either Number One in Heaven or Number One in Heaven and the Noel album written and produced by Ron and Russell, that is Dancing is Dangerous, released just a few months after Number One in Heaven. So Ad, have you been a Sparks fan for a very long time? Do you have like an interesting origin story that you'd like to share?
I do indeed, actually, and I've been preparing for it, and I've even got some props that will help. Now, you might not have seen these, or you might not have seen them for a very long time. Do these look familiar to you?
Yeah.
This is the Profile double compilation.
Yeah.
Now, these came out, I think it was 1990, so it was just in the sort of lean years.
What's the name of that compilation?
Profile, the Ultimate Sparks Collection. Yeah, it's a double CD. Now, the other interesting thing is that it's got sleeve notes by none other than your guest, I think, Monty, Ira Robbins.
Yes.
In fact, it was Ira Robbins.
Yeah, Ira Robbins. So it was his paragraph. I won't read it all. He's written a whole essay here.
I wish I'd remembered that when I talked to him.
What I might do is I might send you the transcript or a scan of it, because it's a great article. And so this was basically my introduction to Sparks. This is how I first came to hear of them. Now, this was 1994, which is also kind of significant, because it was barely a month or two before Gratuitous Sax and When Do I Get to Sing My Way? So from, say, the summer of 1994, I've probably heard of this town. I certainly hadn't heard anything from Number One in Heaven. So I sort of discovered them as what I consider a long forgotten band and a really obscure band. But they intrigued me. The write-up intrigued me, the music intrigued me, particularly the Number One in Heaven stuff, but all of it. Then blow me, about a month or two later, they're suddenly back. My Way's brilliant, massive song. Makes the charts in the UK. And it was just an amazing case of discovering them literally kind of a month before that. And then so from that point onwards, they've always been there as what I consider a contemporary band, literally throughout my adult life. I was at university in London at the time. I was a wee whippersnapper. So, you know, kind of making my way through the adult world, very much into making music and songwriting and electronic music. New Order had always been my favourite band.
Big fan.
So it all, yeah. And Marauder, growing up, I used to love Marauder stuff, what I knew of it, more of the 80s stuff, like Together in Electric Dreams, if you remember that one, with Phil Oakey from the Human League.
Phil Oakey.
Yeah, so that's what I grew up on. And then Sparks were like, everyone mentioned Sparks. Even then, it was, you know, the bands that I like, it all kind of led back to Sparks. I saw them live. Well, I've seen them a couple of times. The first time I saw them was in 99 with Christy on drums at Shepherd's Bush, as very much a kind of electronic based band for Balls. It was, I think they were showcasing some of the Balls songs before it came out. So I first heard those songs live. And then obviously in 04, I think I saw them much more rock based with Dean Mentor on guitar. And they were doing the little Beethoven stuff, if you can call it rock, whatever you call that. So, to see. Yeah. And basically, throughout. And then obviously that goes right up to lockdown and the present day stuff and Latte. And they've just always been an absolute brilliant influence. And it's just amazing what's been going on in the last few years, obviously with the Edgar Wright film and they've just gone next level, but it's like we were right all along. And another, I don't want to sort of rant on too long, because we've got a lot to talk about, but another kind of milestone along that journey with Sparks was being there at the time of their very first website, the first official Sparks website, which was also about the time of Balls. And I was kind of part of that journey, just seeing Sparks come into the kind of, digital era, if you like. And as a result of that, met up with a fair few Sparks fans. We had a couple of conventions and stuff. And made some what I consider life friends through that. So, they've influenced my personal life and my musical life, and just how to live life really, and how to keep going. And if you get, if you've got your niche, just stick at it, and one day people will get it.
So you were just kind of full steam ahead once you discovered them or caught fire with you. You've been. Sounds like you've seen them live a good handful of times and been to a couple of conventions. One thing that's always interesting.
To say I love everything.
I'm sorry?
That's not to say I love everything they do. There's been ups and downs along the way, if you like. But
true. One thing that's always interesting when I talk to a Sparks fan that's either from continental Europe or the UK, is there's usually some kind of general awareness of the band, even if you couldn't name very many of their songs, because they historically have had more of a purchase in Europe and in the UK than over here in the States. So did you find that Sparks were more or less a known quantity even around 1994 when you really started to take that first dive?
Yes and no, I think. I mean, I think a lot of people have sort of heard the name, and they might say, "Oh, it's that funny guy on keyboards and the singer with a high voice," and they probably know This Town, and with a bit of luck they might know. Well, I say this is what it was like then. It's all changed now, I think. So what I'm describing is when I grew up with them first in the 90s, I think in the intervening period, they're a lot more famous now. I think a lot more people, even people I know who didn't really like them or didn't get them, they're just taken as read as kind of almost, I hate to say it, but kind of pop aristocracy now. I mean, they played at Glastonbury last year. It was seen as one of the highlights of the festival. They've really made it. They played at, the Albert Hall. They played at Carnegie Hall. They finally made it, if you like. And that's just so gratifying to see. And it really is. It's when you've been there. I mean, I consider myself a newcomer back in the 90s. I was like a Johnny come lately for people who've been there. Well, some people have been there since very early 70s. So every new generation has sort of come aboard. The thing is, people stay. Once people find Sparks, they stick with them. Have you noticed? It's no one says, "Oh, I used to be a Sparks fan, but I went off them." It's, you're kind of hooked for life once you get there.
Absolutely. Well, you do meet people who knew them in the 70s and then they kind of lost interest a little bit, and often they've come back, but
that's very true.
Yeah, but there's very few once they get their hooks in you, it's you get fascinated by their story and everything and how their journey.
I mean, in some ways, well, I think they said this themselves in interviews, in some ways it's a double-edged sword, because it also means that people have incredibly high expectations for them. So it's not enough for Sparks just to release a kind of good album. People are expecting another Kimono or Number One in Heaven all the time. And, these are like really above average albums, but we kind of remember that as the general standard. and it's like a football team that wins 7-0 or something. It's an amazing achievement, and nobody could do that all the time when you're realistic about it. Clearly, some albums are going to be, well, they're all good in their own way. I don't think there's a bad one, but you know, some are really, really, really good, and others are just pretty good.
Is there a specific incarnation of Sparks or genre or style that particularly appealed to you when you started getting into the band?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The Number One in Heaven era is, and still to this day, that's what for me, Pete Sparks. If you want Pete Sparks, it's the La Dolce Vita video, the official video for that, with all the waveforms in the background. Yeah. Ron just doing the most crazy faces, Russell dancing away. That's, and not even a drummer in the video. I mean, I love the drummers they used. Interestingly, not Keith Forsey for some of their live performances, but that's pure synth duo to me, with the technology, and that to me is, that's what really captures him.
I always just kind of imagined when watching that video that there are some secret room somewhere in Club 54 that a handful of VIPs know about. It's a completely different scene. It's not the Bacchanalian sex and drug fest as the main stage, but here's a little secret, little quiet place where you know, people can indulge in weirder stuff.
Yeah.
Number One in Heaven, would you consider yourself a big fan of electronic pop music in general?
Absolutely. Kind of child of the 80s, so my era really Sparks, when that album wrote the playbook for the music of my childhood, really, without knowing it. And I can say that within the kind of historian hat, that everything I like growing up dates from that sound, from that album, mm-hmm. Whether it's directly or indirectly. So even bands that swear they've never been influenced by Sparks, like the Pet Shop Boys, it's clearly an influence, even if they were influenced by bands who were influenced by them. Give you a good example. Just listening now, Noel, I Want a Man. Listen to that, and then listen to OMD, Enola Gay, and listen to the bass lines, and you'll think that's where they got it from.
I can hear that now.
Yeah.
No. I wouldn't have thought of that because I don't really I'm not a big I'm not so as big into electronic music as you guys, but I do know the song, and now that you mention it, I can definitely hear the connection.
Well, you hear that over and over, and I mean, obviously it's not just with electronic music. That's the funny thing, that was my gateway into Sparks, and I think a lot of, you know, this is the first maybe talking point about Number One in Heaven, and it is that to really get that album, I think you've got to say, okay, this is first and foremost a Sparks album, secondly an electronic album. You've got to go in there as a Sparks fan, and I think that's when it really unlocks itself.
I agree with that 100%. We're talking about Number One in Heaven, right?
And yes.
I mean, to me, it's not even a disco album. That's a whole other discussion. Christian and I had it a few months ago. But to me, it takes disco tools and mechanisms and creates a Sparks album.
It's a Sparks album about disco, and it's inspired by disco. Mm-hmm. But it's a thesis on disco, if you like, or a treatise or whatever they do, comment. And it's got disco elements, but it's beyond that. This is one of the things I was going to write. And I'm not going to, all that stuff I wrote is just kind of notes for myself, by the way, that I can talk about more freestyle. But I think it's, and this is why I think part of the Number One in Heaven thing, it's the death of disco and the birth of something else. It's still dance music, but it's not disco. So we could look at what's the difference. But I think for me, there's a number of key elements. I mean, firstly, the fact that it was recorded a year before it came out is incredible. So people think that's 79. Actually, it's 78, sonically and technologically. I thought it was incredible from 79, but when you consider when it was made, that's very soon after I Feel Love. I mean, how on earth they even got Moroder? I don't know if you know how they managed to snag him, because they were down on their luck. I mean, I don't know if they had a lot of money, but how on earth did they persuade you know, it'd be like me just going up to, I don't know, whoever's really hot now and just saying, oh, can you make a record with me? So how the hell they did it? Credit to them.
I'm trying to remember. Monty, do you recall how that initial spark took place?
What they say in the film is that they were talking to someone or a reporter, and they said, oh, yes, we're working on an album with Giorgio Moroder now. And then Giorgio Moroder was asked about that, and he knew nothing about it, but he was intrigued, and it led to the relationship. Now, I take a lot of things that they say with a grain of salt, but that's the story that they had in the movie. So take it what you will.
Hell of a way to get your foot in the door.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he would have had a lot to lose, didn't he?
I think being around all those years, I mean, I think they still had some respect and some panache, you know, in the music industry. Right. Regardless of the albums that happened to come out right before Number One in Heaven. And I think they still had enough respect that they could go to Giorgio Moroder and say that they had this idea and that he would be a co-producer and he would help make it happen. And I think he wanted to, I think he found that an attractive proposition.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that speaks credit, you know, volumes for them, that they're obviously very professional. They approached it with a good vision and, you know, obviously very persuasive. Yeah. It's a really good example of producer and band, you know, when you get the right producer in the right band and they just go, and all my favorite albums are like that, you know, just that kind of synergy.
You know, I often wonder what those first rehearsals were like, or just the first conversations between Ron and Russ and Giorgio Moroder, and what it was that attracted Giorgio to Sparks, because you don't really get any kind of hint at all prior to Number One in Heaven that they would want to go down the disco / electronic beat or dance music of any kind. I guess they just sort of, the thing is,
you've always been able to dance to this stuff, can't you? It's always upbeat. It's always been upbeat music, and it's always music. I mean, you might need about five legs to dance to some of it, but it's always been very rhythmic, very propulsive. It's kind of up tempo. It's not really downbeat. I mean, you know, they have their moments like these mysteries or something, but you know, it's generally speaking, it's always been up tempo. So I guess it's just another for them. Yeah. It's just another variant of that.
And I think that you know, the last two albums hadn't sold, and they wanted to really break out of the mold, break out of a band mold. And I think they were intrigued by songs like I Feel Love and other songs that they were attracted to for whatever reason. And they said, you know, they said, what do we have to lose? Let's try this. Because things were not going well for them at that time.
I also think that this was the perfect opportunity for them to not even have to bother with the variable of hired band members, hired guns, no longer have to keep up with and teach, you know, your songs to a guitarist and a bassist. I guess they did have a drummer. That was Keith Forsey. but this was the first time that they were really able to cut themselves loose from what I think that they usually saw as a hindrance. Because they really just wanted, you know, the two of them to be the creative force. And this was a perfect opportunity for them to do that. Unless they were just going to be a folk duo. And I think, you know, Ron and Russ have made it clear over the years they're not really into doing the folk duo scene.
Well,
it's like a reverse Dylan, isn't it? Well, it's similar to Dylan, going electric, if you like. It's you're going to have to be saying, kudos.
But well, I really think it's to their credit, because what I said is not determinative. It wasn't like that since their last two albums failed, they therefore had to do this. This was a conscious choice that they made. They could have come out with another rock album, kind of trying to recapture the Kimono sound. That would have been a very logical thing to do, right? But they didn't. They didn't do that. They went. They just said, okay, let's try this, but let's make it work. Let's make it a Sparks album.
You can't say they copied anyone, can you? I mean, who was their influence? Because obviously Donna Summer,
other than Giorgio,
singer. Well, I mean, in terms of Sonics and Donna Summer in terms of singing, but what other template did they have at the time? It's there was no template for them. It's, you know, it's a whole new genre, a whole new. I mean, although sonically it's obviously based on I Feel Love, it is a different genre. Yeah. That, you know, it's taking that technology and that sound, but it's doing something very different with it. Very different.
I really like what you said about the right producer and the right band, because he let them produce a Sparks album. He didn't try to mold them into a disco group. He let them do a Sparks album, but he did it in his style. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it works. And another conversation Christian and I have had, and we don't have to get into now, is that on the next album was kind of reversed. They were kind of forced into a disco mold, and that a lot of the Sparks elements got lost. But on this album, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it was almost going back to introducing Sparks again, wasn't it? Session musicians out of their hands, a sort of corporate way of doing it. It was almost everything they were sort of trying to get away from, and it sort of came back to follow them again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, Ron finally gets a chance to shine a spotlight on his keyboard playing, you know, which was, you know, always been his focus on the records, his focus when playing.
Yeah,
I think they were happy to, and they made it kind of a public to do about it. Guitars were gone.
Yeah,
you know, guitars are passe, and we'll never have them again. I was thinking about the relationship that they had with Giorgio, and you know who was getting what out of that that partnership, and I think Giorgio probably relished the opportunity to see how you could take the sound that he had honed over the last several years and actually sort of hammer them into the shape of pop songs.
Absolutely.
As opposed to I Feel Love. I Feel Love is a banger, but it's meant for the dance floor. You know, there's lyrically, there's not a whole lot going on, and it doesn't have the same structure, you know, that you have in something that was more, you know, I guess Beatles based, chorus, verse, changing up time signatures sometimes, and you know, changing up the chords, or you know, God forbid, change a key in the middle of the song. These weren't things that were happening in dance music up to that point very much, I don't think.
No, and you know, you I know there's the extended 12-inch mixes for the, and you can dance to them, and Beat the Clock I have danced to in a disco. I met Tammy Wynette that night. It's my claim to fame.
Cool.
She pulled up in her limo, came into the disco, and left 5 minutes later. But hey, but the point
she
I was going to make.
Monty, you make me want to D-I-V-O-R-C-E, my husband.
But what I was going to say is you can't dance to most of these songs. I mean, you could, but it would be really weird. You know, dancing to, think about the lyrics. You know, these are just not disco friendly lyrics. It's weird to imagine dancing to Tryouts for the Human Race.
Yeah, well, even though the beat is there, the rhythm is there, the four on the floor is definitely present. And I think, you know, I could imagine that song coming on a dance floor in a dance club somewhere, and you know, and people would start dancing up until Russell starts singing those lyrics
or warbling away in his falsetto.
Exactly.
Well, can I ask you guys a question then? Do you think maybe that the Noel album is almost, that is the disco album? So Number One in Heaven is the album about disco, and maybe Noel is the disco album, because in terms of songs are much more longer, and how they put together is a whole other topic to talk about, but you know, it's more straight disco in a way, even though it's still kind of a bit wonky. It's, you know, it's not, it's always going to be.
I would agree with that musically. Yeah.
Well, and I think it's in the structure of the album, in that you've got two suites of music that play nonstop, which is what you'd expect from a DJ mix. Of course, there's always something meta going on with Sparks when they do anything. So I think it was probably, I mean, it's a disco record, but it's also a disco record in some ways about a disco record, or about disco music.
Yes.
You know, there's always some kind of fourth wall, some sort of postmodernist bent to it that just tells you that this is not going to be by the numbers. There's something else going on.
But I think I'm talking to now about the Noel album, said that sly, diabolical Ron Mayall always has something he needs to say. Always has something he wants to throw in there. And I love those words, sly and diabolical.
Who
those is words the person I'm talking to about the Noel album that we're going to record in a couple weeks.
Fantastic.
Yeah. But you said something in your notes. You said that it's a treatise on the idea of life cycles at their most elemental level.
Wow.
Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, yeah, okay. So now we're really getting down into the album, the deep dive we've talked a bit about, you know, the kind of the sound of the album and its background with Giorgio Moroder. So we've established that they've teamed up and they've got all this equipment. What are they going to write an album about? What's it going to be about? Lots and lots of different interpretations for me of all the songs. And Paul's stuff is absolutely fantastic. And I read every word he's written and watch his videos. And, you know, he's really, really on the case. But I think there's so many different interpretations that's why I say elemental, because everything has a life cycle. Whether it be a band or a government or a relationship or a human being or a company, you know, everything is born, it has its sort of peak and then it dies, and then it has a kind of legacy or an afterlife. And to apply that to the album, and it's pretty literal in a sense, it starts with tryouts for the human race and it ends in heaven. So that, you know, what more do you need to say? That's where it starts, that's where it ends, and how does it get there from A to B? You know, the journey it takes, I think, again, it's fairly elemental in that everything starts. I like the idea of a tryout, not just for a human race, but a tryout for anything, a prototype. You know, how did you guys start your podcast? You maybe tried out an idea, and then obviously that becomes, or one of us might make it through. Songwriting itself, Paul would say, you know, tryouts for songs, attempts to maybe get with someone at a disco. It might work, it might not. Everything starts with a sort of tryout, and eventually, whatever it may be, you get lucky or you get practice if you keep trying. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? And I think the song, the song itself, if we could start, maybe, I don't know if it's all right to just go straight into tryouts as we're here. And by all means, I'll put my bit out, and I'm really interested to know what you think, and, you know, tell me what this means to you. But the song itself, it has a sort of frustrating quality, I feel. And I've worked out just before doing this what's frustrating about it, or what makes it frustrating. I don't mean bad, and I don't mean it's frustrating to listen to, but what I mean is, if you look at the structure of a song, the verses have sort of 16th beat. It's very fast, it's really fast. Then the chorus comes in and it becomes an 8th beat. So it's almost kind of a letdown. You've got this kind of energy, it's running. And where does it go? It just goes. And it's, you know, the first time I heard that, I was like, it's an awful chorus. And then the second time, the second iteration of the chorus, it sort of holds together a bit more. You've got more synths in there. And then you have this brilliant the instrumental bit with those really sweeping synths and the brilliant, brilliant kind of climax. Let us out of here, let us out of here. And then the third verse, and then you listen at the end, and then the final chorus has finally got the dibba 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 dibba. So it sort of resolves. It's a really clever trick. And I literally only just noticed that before talking to you now. And that's just one example of how the music, just in musical form, can tell a story, even if it was instrumental. As I said, it's even if you just heard an instrumental of that song, it would tell a story of sort of like attempts to do something, not quite making it, going back down, trying again. And then you've got the kind of that brilliant middle eight where it all holds mm-hmm. together. And then it just kind of gets there at the end.
Yeah, there's some really cool. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, just one other thing to just, and then I'll just to illustrate that point, how you can really hear what I'm saying. If you listen to the 7-inch radio mix of that, they've totally done away with that structure, and it cuts straight to the fast chorus, and you can hear that makes it a lot more kind of radio friendly, but you lose the build up, mm-hmm. and maybe that's why it wasn't so big a hit as Beat the Clock and Number One in Heaven, because although it was really good sonically, the radio edit it didn't really do what the song was supposed to be doing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Because yeah, I'm with you. There's a lot of drama in the way the musical phrasing changes from part A to part B to part C.
Yes.
And one thing that they started doing on this album, and I don't know if this was common for dance music at that time, but I think in this song, but certainly in Beat the Clock in the middle, that middle eight, if you want to call it that, is a breakdown, you know, like you yes. hear in modern dance music, electronic music.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, totally.
And I don't know if that was something new for the ears of most listeners, but it sounds really modern today.
Yeah. So, I mean, the question is, and this is a question, and I don't know if you guys know or have any ideas, how did they make this? Did they have any kind of computers? How did they do it? How did they write it? How did they...
right.
How on earth did they record it?
It would almost be a great documentary, wouldn't it?
I'd love to know. No one ever talks about it.
This is the kind of thing that the Sparks Brothers movie did not get into that a lot of fans wish they had. Yeah.
I think particularly with this album, because I think as the 80s rolled in and you could do all this stuff with a synthesizer, you just, you know, got sort of $50 or whatever. So Number One in Heaven has a really special, it's almost like it's very unique in terms of the time. It was electronic music, but not quite digital. It was just on the cusp of a real change in forever in what I call quantized music. I.e. absolutely digitally precise, so that it won't mm-hmm. go out of time. Do, 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 do. And so disco pretty much up to, and it's really on the cusp, because you've got Keith Forsey, who's a live drummer, mm-hmm. yet he's playing along to sort of perfectly sequenced synthesizers. So the synthesizers, they're obviously on a loop. They're obviously almost robotic in how they're playing. You know, it's just a constant loop. And yet you've got a live drummer playing with that. It's incredible, and I've got more questions than answers. But it's just what an achievement, what an absolute achievement all around.
Yeah. So my understanding as it relates to how they actually recorded that album was they had the Moog modular, I think it was a 3P, but you know, the modules, it's huge, takes up half a room, no sequencers whatsoever, and I believe the arpeggiator could be fussy sometimes. It would sometimes go out of phase or go out of key a little bit. So Giorgio, or you know, whoever was doing the engineering in real time, had to stay on those controls and make those little changes. So there was no sequencing of any kind, which just impresses me so much more when I think about the fact that everyone, or really just Ron, is having to play in time. And then you've got, you know, Keith Forsey, who I believe he would record a few bars or a few measures, and then they would loop that, but then he would go back in and do fills and and all that.
But again, that's very, very, very ahead of its time, because that's basically breakbeat.
Yeah.
I mean, 10 years later, people would plunder old records to get live drum sounds. See, this is where Number One in Heaven is almost 10 years ahead of its time, because it was, again, it was just on the cusp of live drums going out, drum machines or MIDI drums coming in, you know, electronic drums, and again, the Noel album. But Number One in Heaven is still very much a live drummer. But then 10 years later, people would then go back to break beats because they mm-hmm. wanted the kind of funk of a live drummer. And the way, I think you can really hear that in My Other Voice, particularly with the backwards cymbals, where it's you know, nobody could play that live. But it's a live drummer, but he's doing stuff that's mm-hmm. manipulated, and it's, you know, it's just layered. There's lots of different layers. He'd need about 5 arms to play all that stuff in one go. There's cymbals where there's snares, and it's all overlaid. And sometimes that can sound a bit messy if you're not in the mood. I found with Number One in Heaven. And this is what I mean, like, you've got to take it as a sparks record, because that manic energy becomes a positive and it becomes a selling point. Whereas if you're looking, and this is made for the problem of Terminal Jive, that's a lot more locked in. It's a lot more, like, it's a lot more, it's over-processed in a different way. Mm. It's weird. It's hard to explain. Number One in Heaven.
No, I think you've explained it great. I mean, Terminal Jive is a little too good. It's too smooth. And yes, we all agree the production is great, mm-hmm. you know, from the production standpoint. But, yes, you know, it's just, this one has that human element just coming all out all over it. And, you know, and the drumming just adds to that human element.
Definitely. Absolutely. And I think it also, the songs get to breathe more on that album than, say, Terminal Jive. It just, Terminal Jive just sounds and feels more regimented to me, and sometimes even overstuffed. And I think they successfully avoid doing that on Number One in Heaven. I mean, you can count the number of tracks that you actually hear, you know, and it's not very many, like 4 or maybe 5. You got the drums and you've got a bass line on the Moog, and very often those are going to be 16th notes. And then, you know, you maybe got like a lead that Ron's playing, and, you know, beyond that and beyond Russell singing, I mean, they did have a syndrome, and I know that they were wanting initially to try to make, to do everything synthetic so that the drums would be syndrome as well, but the technology just wasn't there yet.
I think as well, it's this is something else I've written about, is the idea that I love this, the idea of the Deus Ex Machina, the God from the machine, and you know, in terms of drama, when the plot can't really be resolved by any kind of earthly means, they'd wheel up this great big contraption, and the gods would put everything right, and everything would be resolved. And in a way, that's kind of what electronic music probably was for the males. It was the answer mm-hmm. to their prayers. But part of its appeal and part of its aesthetic, and this is so well captured on the inner sleeve photo on Number One in Heaven, you know, with Ron and Russell, the great big wall of synths. Mm-hmm. It's an aesthetic mm-hmm. thing. It's, you know, the aesthetic of electronica, if you like. That sounds so pretentious, the aesthetic of electronica, but it's very much, you know, again, it's an album about electronica, and the cover is very clinical. You know, it's got the human thing as well, but it's Terminal Jive doesn't really seem to be about stuff on the same way. Paul would probably argue, but
no, I think Paul would argue, yes, but but I think my viewpoint is a little bit more aligned with yours. But Paul would definitely have a different perspective, which he has brought out quite effectively.
And it's very, very persuasive.
But when we get to the next song, there seems to be two themes that you're developing here. And one is is the life cycle theme. But then you're also talking about Ron and Russell kind of defining where they are, and how disco is almost a, not allegory, but it almost is a way that they use to tell their story.
Yeah. And this is their tryout. This is like their musical tryouts.
Yeah.
But I'm saying when you take it a step, yeah. now take it to the next song with Academy Award performance.
Yeah.
So I'm just hoping you can develop those themes a little bit. Because I think I must.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Sorry. Okay. So now we were just saying that this is a different album and a different style from, say, Donna Summer, I Feel Love. Now, in terms of time frame, I mean, if this was recorded in 78, I think that was recorded 77, wasn't it? So we're talking months, weeks or months after. So, I mean, it's, you know, you think what was a few weeks and months ago, it was, well, Latte came out about almost a year ago now, maybe. So that's the time frame we're talking about. That seems like nothing. So you think it's only that time frame after I Feel Love's been recorded. It's still incredibly fresh still, incredibly new. There haven't been any templates that I can think of. And I think Academy Award performance is so acrobatic musically. Mm-hmm. This is where they really, yes, Tryouts is maybe still kind of disco based. It's still kind of on that I Feel Love template to an extent. But I think Academy Award is where they become very Sparks. This is full on Sparks. It's hyper acrobatic. The operatic almost section with the vocals in the middle. It's up and down. It's so many different chords. Again, how the heck they put this all together without a computer? I mean, because it's, you know, it's composed. How did they get a bit? I'd love to know. And, you know, if by any chance Ron and Russell or anyone sees this, there's lots to be said there about how this was all done. But you think how complicated that song is.
Yeah.
And yet how immaculately, when you listen to it, it's nothing, it's just so well put together. And all the synth sounds, it's just this splurge of sounds, isn't it?
I like that you used the word acrobatic to describe that song, because this is, whereas the first song on the album is definitely about a kind of performance. and this one is too, in its own way. I mean, it's right there in the title. There's that, the acrobatic nature, I think, of that song really kind of underscores this performance element and just the busyness.
And the
propulsiveness.
Busy. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a busy song. And one of the things that you said is that it's not just about a woman trying to make it and putting on a performance. It's really about a whole phase of life where you're trying to figure it out, right?
That's absolutely, yeah. And although it's kind of, I mean, again, I think all these levels are right. I would never say, oh, this is the right interpretation. They're all right, you know? And if anyone listens to any Sparks song and they get something from that song, that's great. So, that, you know, these are just my additions to the plot, if you like. But with this one, I'd see it as a positive song. A lot of people say it's kind of maybe a bit bitchy or a bit catty, and it's about maybe some fate. But I think it's, and I, if you remember, I mentioned some other songs that I think it's instructive to listen to as well. Popularity, Get in the Swing, Sports. It's maybe a recurring theme, this sort of love-hate relationship Sparks have with popularity. They chase it, they kind of despise it. They kind of see through it. They get that it's all a big performance. But yeah,
you and Paul are peas in a pod.
Yeah, well, I've loved this stuff. And maybe, you know, if we ever do a panel thing, we could take some of the ideas further. But yeah, I mean, how does that sound to you guys? What do you think? That it's kind of celebrating it. It's saying, yeah, you got to perform. And I think it is also tips for teens. I think it is aimed at younger people, and it's sort of life advice kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm right on with it. I mean, like I said, I think pretty much every song on this album is about some aspect of the performative nature of life.
Yeah.
That all of the protagonists and all of the songs, you know, they're not content to just to live, to go through life unexamined. It's always for, there's It's always a performance.
All the world's
it's always
stage.
built to influence, impress, something like that. There's
yes.
artificiality all through it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
I do hear all that. I can't say I fully see it as a positive song, though. I feel that it's kind of, it's just capturing puberty in a lot of ways. It's capturing growing up and how difficult that can be. You know?
I mean, there's maybe not cynicism positive, in there. But there's cynicism in all of it.
Isn't that one of the things that makes folks unique, though? That it's cynicism, but there's a kind of warm heart to it, or affection. It sort of knows these things. It can see through the sort of stupidities of human behavior, but it's not out and out nasty or misanthropic. It's just sees the absurdity and sort of ridicules it. It's, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad to hear you say that. And I haven't really heard anyone put it quite so succinctly.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, for sure. No. Yeah, this cynicism, but with a light touch or a wink or something.
Well, I think it's the fact they don't see themselves as superior. And that leads us on to Leto Chivita, Step Up, Follow Me. It's that, you know, Ron's always first to make a fool out of himself in a way before making a fool out of anyone else. And I think that makes it very humble. And that's why he can say a lot of the things he says, because he's not coming at it from a place of superiority or snobbery or anything. It's,
You're absolutely right. And, you know, they've had 26 albums, 350 songs. I can think of one where they were kind of lecturing, and that would be iPhone. One out of 350 is a pretty good track record. You know, they don't lecture you. They relate to you. They understand what we're all going through.
That's kind of a small miracle, because the ingredients were always there.
Right.
And a lot of songwriters and just people start to tilt in that direction as they get older anyway. You know, just a grouchy condemnation of, you know, whatever is new in society right now.
That's where I am in life at this, by the way. Grouchy condemnation of all this newfangled shit.
I'm not too far behind you. I won't get on Snapchat. I'm not doing the Snapchat. Weird.
No,
I
that's
just
great.
Have one other thing about the music as well, for and how the music explains all this in Academy Award performance, is that I think it's very dazzly music, and I think it was done to dazzle people, and it's very ostentatious, and the electronics are just absolutely mind-blowing. And it's, if you listen to the very intro, now I was going to say, a lot of songs have a sort of beat that fades in, and this is the sort of like ongoing thing, the beat fades in, the fades out. But with Academy Award performance, it's straight in, comes crashing in. You've got synths just coming from all directions. And it's very much a look at me sort of song. And it works. It's kind of showing off what they can do. And yeah, they can do it brilliantly.
In most of these songs, there's always like one, either a particular instrumental track, or there's a certain sound, or like a measure or whatever that really gets me. And for this song, is that the fat synth, I guess, bass line that you hear during the chorus, or it's just kind of alternating between the two keys, the two notes.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It hits me down here.
It's kind of got a similar sound to Gary Numan, which would have been not long after, similar sort of time. And in terms of influence, I think Academy Award performance is really, really the template. You know, I was saying about 80s synth pop. I think that song, that's not disco, that's synth pop now. It's definitely something different. It's too fast to be normal disco. It's a different tempo. It's a different kind of accent in a way. And it's almost in line with more with the Keith Forsey stuff with Billy Idol, you know, like White Wedding and stuff, that kind of tempo. Not faster, so it's very much a kind of a progenitor of a lot of the 80s stuff, some of the later Blondie stuff that and obviously the synth soft cell.
I mean, if the definition of disco is that you can dance to it in a disco, there's no way you would put this song on. People would say, what the hell are we, what's going on here?
it's
yeah, the rhythm's too as well, isn't it? It's different. It's yeah. not a basic four on the floor with a predictable hi-hat. And
I think tryouts and Beat the Clock and a little bit of the of Number One and Song in Heaven, maybe the second half a little bit, are the only places where you could say, oh, that has a traditional disco structure on the entire album.
Yeah, definitely.
Which is just amazing how groundbreaking it is.
And this is why I love having Monty on this show, because he's a drummer, and I know almost basically nothing about drumming. I've got my drum machine and I know how to program some simple beats on it and whatever. But I love having the opportunity to ask Monty about drumming related stuff.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's it in terms of the disco stuff. That's it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't dance to La Dolce Vita with all the changes and then the little rhythm, you know, the little break in the middle where they do the little keyboard solo or synthesizer solo.
Those drum fills in Academy, I mean, they're amazing, aren't they? The drums in the middle of Academy Award.
Yeah. Oh, so, that's my favorite part of the album.
Oh,
On headphones.
It's brilliant.
There aren't enough headphones Sparks albums. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah. But you mentioned La Dolce Vita. And that's the next song on the album.
Yeah.
This is a top 10 Sparks song for me. And for me, for Sparks, it's always very hard for me to separate the songs out from the albums. The albums stand alone as their own edifice, their own piece of music. But this song in particular really strikes me as a beautiful, meaningful song. And you make the point that it's another area where the males are describing what they're doing.
I think so. So in our life cycle, so this is, you know, the meta narrative is the life cycle, and I like how we're sort of going into detail on each of the songs. But as you can see, there is a kind of arc that's going. So we started with the tryouts being born, and then, you know, the sort of maybe school or early adult life, learning how to perform, learning how to kind of, you know, how the world works, if you like. Now, I think with La Dolce Vita, we're sort of in, you know, young to mid adulthood, if you like, or you know, in the middle of a section. And I think this song for me is very much a kind of a song where you've got, well, I liken it to the week and the weekend. So you've got the workaday week, and then you've got the kind of hedonistic weekend, whatever they get up to, is that, you know, in a late 70s disco. But so, you know, and that's reflected in a way in the lyrics, you know, looking real bored, it's hard as scrubbing floors. It's very much about being paid, gold diggers arise. It's about commerce, it's about money. But it's kind of, again, it's that sort of, I don't really mind, or we're doing it anyway, we're no better than anyone else, we all have to do it. And then I think when you get the kind of instrumental bit, that's where it's more reflective. You can kind of see it in the video where Russell starts dancing and Ron sort of looking pensive, and that's like you kind of what I call trance dance. And again, I think that's you know, 90s trance really goes back to that song, really. But it's just disco that takes you to a different place, you know, hallucinogenic, if you like. Just in the music, just in the swirls and the kind of stereophonic sounds, and a brilliant drumming from Keith here. I think the middle section of this is probably my favorite section of all this drumming, where It's just rave in a way. It's so flying. It's space disco. It's beyond disco, space dance, whatever. But it's beyond disco. It's afterlife disco. It's something new that didn't at this point even have a name. That's why I'm trying to struggle to name it, because it's everything. It's the roots of everything. It's the roots of trance. It's the roots of sort of drum and bass. It's the roots of house or stuff, you know. It's the roots of techno. It's all the roots of all this stuff. Yeah, at the time it was none of them, because they didn't exist. So it's a groundbreaking piece of music, and it is probably my favorite Sparks song ever.
Is that right? Yeah,
really. Yeah, it's just, I love it, absolutely love it.
What do you think was going through Ron and Russell and Giorgio's minds as they were making this album? Was it like, oh, this is a song, this is cool, this will work, or is it, we're doing something really groundbreaking here?
That's a great question.
No, I have no idea.
And I'd like to think it was the latter. I'd like to think they really thought this is something groundbreaking. It feels like it. I don't think it's stuff which is sort of...
I get the impression...
Let's see.
I get the impression that they felt like they were doing something unique and special with number one in heaven.
Maybe that's what...
Yeah, that brings...
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Well, it actually brings me on to another point and another thing that I think that's really got to be said. That a lot of people just say Moroder, far from electronic music, and I no way would disagree with that. But if we're brutally honest, there's an awful lot of mediocre Moroder stuff, stuff that's not very good. And I think some of the people you guys have spoken to have said this, that his quality control was a bit iffy, maybe. Yes. And a really good example, listen to that Elton John album from 1979. It's also got Keith Forsey on drums. I don't know if it's Moroder or Faltermeyer, but it's that stable. But it's the most sort of mediocre, plodding. In some ways, it kind of sounds like Terminal Jive. But I think you listen to that and you hear what Sparks bring to the party. So I think they elevated Moroder. And I think they brought something out of him that obviously Donna Summer had done, but not many other people really did in the same way. He needed them as much as they needed him to be.
Maybe he needed to be challenged a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
Have either of you two listened to much in the way of Moroder's solo work?
Not me.
Not a great deal of us to flip.
Yeah, I did my homework on Moroder solo when we were preparing to do the number one in heaven episode for the podcast a couple years ago. And I mean, he was basically producing. He was before he was a dance music producer, he was producing a different kind of music. He did do a singer-songwriter thing in the late 60s, early 70s, but it was bubblegum, like beat combo. It was nothing like what he ended up doing with Donna Summer or anything like that. But what struck me is the same year, pretty sure it was after chronologically Number One in Heaven came out, he released an album. The title escapes me at the moment, but he seems to be trying to have his own. He's trying to make a disco-like album, but with songs in a pop song structure. And sometimes it works pretty well and other times not so much, but I can't help but think that he was applying maybe some of the lessons that he learned from Ron and Russell while they were recording that album, and how you can take this aesthetic and you can make pop out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. 80s pop, basically. 80s synth, rock, pop, dance, right. New wave. Whatever you want to call it, but yeah, the sound of the 80s, really. And it all came, I would say, from that meeting of minds, from Sparks bringing in the kind of the rock band and Moroder bringing in the electronics, and it just meeting in the middle and creating something else.
I'm sorry to keep harping on this aspect of things, but why isn't this a disco record? I mean, the whole album, or up and to the point we've discussed so far, what distinguishes this from disco in your opinions?
What's it? I've lost.
Is it gone?
I've lost your sounds, Monty, if you can hear.
Uh-oh. Hold on.
No, it's just me. It's got a barking dog here.
All right.
So trying to have respect for you two, I'm trying to, I kind of answered it before, so I'm interested in what you thought. I mean, to me, this is not an album that you could just put on and dance to. And but I guess what I'd add is that it forces you to pay attention and really listen to it. You can listen to, how a song is structured, like some of the Hot Stuff or Donna Summer stuff or some of the other stuff that he's done, and that's fine. But this one, it really forces you. The lyrics and the vocals and the style of the vocals and the song structures, all of them challenge what would be a traditional disco format, in my opinion. And so, you know, with the disco record, you know, I actually had a few at one point in my life. You could just put it on and there it is and you dance to it and that's it. This one you're forced to pay attention to, or you're missing out on a lot of great stuff, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, I think the fact that it's Marauder is kind of what gives its unique sound. But I think he was trying to not make it a strict disco album from his end. Mm. Because he didn't. Yeah. And that gets to what we were saying before. I think he forced that on Terminal Jive. It was kind of forced into that format a little bit more. So that's my two cents. Over to you, Mr. Rebirth.
Yeah, you see, well, Rebirth is a case in point here, because I think you've got to look at dance music in its widest possible meaning throughout the history of humanity, music that people can dance to. And then you've got to look at disco as just a mere fashion trend that lasted about 10 years, if that. Before disco, you know, you maybe had kind of Motown and funk. Before that, maybe, you know, it's a rock and roll. So that's dance music in a way, you know, and if you drive to, and there's always been, before that you had jazz and big bands. So disco, it was just one iteration of dance music. And I think the end of disco is spectacularly swift culturally. The downfall of disco is unlike the downfall of any other genre that I can think of. When you think of, you had that disco sucks rally, you had there was the actual music industry crash in 79, I believe.
Yeah,
where basically all the disco records sale, Casablanca label, which I think that's the one I Feel Love was on, they went bankrupt. So disco, the death of disco was a genuine thing. Now, bearing in mind that happened in 79 and the Males recorded this in 78, it's a real shame it didn't get released earlier, because I think had it done, it would have been seen as maybe a lot more prescient. And the fact that it was kind of put back a bit through no fault of their own, just record label politics, meant that even though it's still ahead of its time, it's maybe weeks or months ahead of its time instead of kind of a year ahead of its time. Yeah. I think they saw the way the wind was blowing. They saw that disco was, you know, as reflected in the lyrics, it was peaking. It was getting to a point where it was unsustainable, and it was going to die, but something would replace it. A new kind of dance music, the number one song in heaven indeed. So that's what I mean by this. It's post-disco, it's disco itself. And, you know, musically, there were still a few bands that carried on doing disco after that. Like people like Kool and the Gang still had hits, Earth, Wind and Fire. But it was a harder sound. Hip-hop started to come in, electro. You know, disco is just, it pretty much ended in 79, more or less. And that's why Number One in Heaven is almost like a requiem for that era and beginning of something whole new for the 80s.
Interesting. Yeah, the whole thing could have sounded like Rod Stewart.
Yeah.
Oh, well. No,
they
really went in all the way.
Yeah. Because it's about disco.
It's not just window dressing.
On disco. Yeah. They're not just trying to be disco. They're commenting on it, and they're using tropes from disco to make that point. But it's almost like, you know, characters. And like I say, with La Dolce Vita, the instrumental sections are like kind of a, you know, you could almost reimagine a video with that flashing to the dance floor, and then you come back to the everyday life and you go back to that bit.
So take that thought and carry it over to the next song, Beat the Clock, where you really specifically have a disc structured song. And how is that a song about disco in a disco format?
Yeah, well, okay, so it's definitely disco, like you say, and it's probably one of the most pure disco on there. And as Christian, you were saying, it's, you know, the breakdown is very much a case of actually basically dancing just to drums, and that's almost tribal in a way. It's it's kind of getting rid of all the strings that you might have had in normal disco, you know, these great big lavish orchestrations. It's very primal, it's very kind of back to basics, almost kind of Afrocentric in a funny sort of way, as Afrocentric sparks them again. It's very much about what dance music, or disco anyway, was always about. And again, it's the break of the song, which otherwise is about kind of speeding through life, really, just you know, just it's rushing through. And I guess that's, you know, that's that point in a life cycle of something where you start to, you don't want to think about the end of it yet. You're almost deluding yourself that everything's still great, and which leads very well into the next track. But for now, yeah, Beat McClure, it's almost that hyper acrobatic thing again, to the point of how long can you keep this up? Mm-hmm.
It's so about it's how you've lived your life, right? I mean, he lived his life in overdrive. And then in the next track, which we don't have to get to yet, but the next track,
yeah,
it comes back to him. You know, it doesn't matter what you did. Everything you accomplished doesn't matter. Here I come. Yeah. Yeah.
I think the tracks do relate together. Yeah. And I think, you know, obviously it's fed, they're sort of separate songs in a sense. But if you look at the meta narrative, or one of the possible meta narratives, definitely Beat McClure's place in the album. It's sort of beginning of side two. It's the pop single, that and Number One in Heaven. But I think in the UK, that was the biggest hit. And it's one of their most accessible songs. And as you were saying, it's got the remix, which really, really was pioneering, I think. And I've got it, you see behind me, that and Tryouts, the blue picture discs.
I see it now that you pointed out. I see it there.
Absolutely fantastic.
You know, I just realized.
Yeah, so it's a great song.
I can imagine Dick Around being sort of the flip side to this thematically.
Yeah. I mean,
Dick Around, yes. I've already lived my life of impossible accomplishments in a short amount of time. And now I'm going to while away the rest of my days.
What a great thought. Yeah.
And there's another thing as well. Sorry. Yeah. What do you say?
Oh no! I just wanted to say just one more little thing before we move on, if that's what we were about to do. From Beat the Clock is there's a primitiveness that really strikes me, particularly in those parts of the song where maybe all you hear is just like the drum track and you hear the bass, the bump,
yeah,
bump, 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 which is really really appealing to me. And it's kind of, and it must have taken, it must have been hard for Ron specifically, maybe both of them, to resist the urge to layer on more sounds. Like if you're familiar with his, how to jam proof your composition, credo, you know, where it was basically all about why do something familiar? You go, if you can make it wacky, stranger, if you can make it more complex, do it.
Yeah.
And all of those impulses are like nowhere to be found on this song in particular. And I think it works, not in spite of, but maybe even because of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting as well, but we know that, this was one of the first songs that he played Giorgio. So I don't know if it was the first they recorded.
Oh.
And it was originally supposed to be like a Lou Reed thing, apparently. So it's amazing to think where it could have ended up. But this, another thing I just wanted to say, and I wanted to say this is another recurring theme through the album. I think the idea of competition and rivalry, and that's another big Sparks thing, this town, obviously, things like Happy Underground. That's where at work, at home, you've got to catch here. It's very much about competition. And I think Tryouts of the Human Race starts that with the sort of competition. You know, one of us might make it through, all the rest will disappear like to you. And that the backing vocals don't get a lot of credit in this album, but they're on Tryouts and they're there on Beat McClure. And they've got this sort of almost laddie quality to them, you know, and it's kind of quite sort of testosterone-y, let's just say. So I think they definitely have the sense of kind of male ego, if you like, just competition, rivalry. And I think that's another big part of Ron's lyrics. He's a big observer of that.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely. Did either of you guys have anything else you guys wanted to say about Beat the Clock?
It's really fun.
It is fun.
Yeah.
It is fun.
It is fun, but that just goes to the multiple ways you can listen to a Sparks album.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Yeah, there's sort of like a guilty pleasure element to a lot of aspects to this album, I think, sometimes. Just because, you know, disco music is just so rooted in hedonism and easy pleasures.
Oh, I just thought of one final thing, actually, and it really is the final thing, because it's the very end of Beat the Clock. Have you ever noticed that at the very end of Beat the Clock, the synth almost replicates Tryouts of the Human Race? If you listen carefully, it's very subtle. Yeah, it almost repeats that.
Okay,
and
yeah.
You wonder if that's a sort of joke, maybe, or a
descending thing, yeah.
Well, you know, maybe like that point in someone's life where maybe they're having children of their own, or... It's like the idea is now starting to seed other ideas. It's have a listen though. The very end of Beat the Clock, and you'll hear a little synth front that sounds almost like a...
No, I hear it. Yeah. Now that you say it, I hear it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nice. Beautiful. Shall we move on to track 5?
Yes, but I have a question for Mr. Rebirth before we do. Do you see significance in the fact that it comes to that full stop ending, which is the first song, the only song on the entire album,
I hadn't noticed that. Full stop.
I hadn't either. I'd noticed the beginnings, but you're right. Absolutely. Yeah. It has a proper start and a kind of full end. Yeah. Interesting.
It's like that's the end of living the life. Yeah. Now you're going to the next phase of ramping it down.
Or,
if
you know,
we believe this whole theory.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so far I'm on board with considering this a concept album about the, a human life cycle.
Where Paul's mainly coming at it from the lyrics. I'm sort of coming at it from the music, and I think they mesh together really well. So I think you both, they're almost separate stories that tell the same story. And so if you listen to the music, we've had this music that started as kind of disco and kind of faded in and kept sort of having its full starts and then built to the beat. Then we had the bright lights and the kind of glamour and the glitz and the energy and the acrobatics of the award performance. Then we sort of reached that kind of like alternating, midlife bit where you got work, you've got discos, mm-hmm. Maybe mundanity mixed with this kind of hedonism, La Dolce Vita. Then Beat the Clock, it's starting to, kind of almost accelerate now, and it's almost like a runaway train to a certain extent. And, we're definitely in the second half of the life cycle now, which takes us into My Other Voice.
It does. It does. Nice. As I said to Christian when we went over this album, my mom loved this song for some reason.
Oh, wow. She's got taste.
Can I just sort of deviate just for a quick moment? Are either of you guys XTC fans?
Yeah.
Yes. I just saw a documentary about them, and it was really interesting.
Yeah, I think I know the one that you're talking about. This is Pop. Their Skylarking album, which is probably their most well-known heralded album, which was produced by Todd Rundgren. I wonder if Andy Partridge and Colin and all them were inspired at all by this album thematically, because it's also about a human life cycle. It starts off with birth and goes through all the trials of growing up and then growing old and then death. But then again, I'm sure this is not it can't be that, that fresh of an idea. I started wondering about that, particularly, in that Venn diagram, you've got Todd Rundgren in the middle of that as well. Not that he had anything to do with this.
I think if there is a sort of wider thing here, I suppose it's about the creative process. And everything's created, if you want to get metaphysical creation and stuff. So they're creative spirits, they're writing about creativity. And, if that, that's really the fundamental here. It's about the creative process and it's about creation. And so therefore that can apply to whatever you want that to apply to. In this case, we're looking at it through the kind of filter of electronic dance music, but there's many other filters you could look at it through as well.
So my other voice, it took me a long time for this to really sink in to my psyche, I guess, because so much else of the album is in your face and demands your attention. And then this is not that. So what are your thoughts on this song and in general or in particular? Ad, do you have anything you'd like to?
Well, Ad, before you go, let me just point out, you used a wonderful word when you wrote about this. You said it has an autumnal quality.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and I compare it to some more of Moroder's work from the 80s. I don't know if you watched Scarface, and he did the soundtrack to that. And towards the end of it, you know, the music in that, the main, like, even the theme, Push It to the Limit, that's very post Number One in Heaven, Moroder, up tempo, 80s synthpop, which probably wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for Number One in Heaven. I think, you know, that this is the kind of thing that it becomes of influence. But as the film, so that's when Tony Montana's sort of, you know, living the high life, fast up tempo stuff. And then he takes more and more drugs and he gets more and more paranoid and he's got more and more people after him. And the music, and credit to Moroder for doing this, but it really starts kind of slowing down and the synths become more moody and it becomes more ponderous. And I think this is it. My Other Voice is a kind of precursor to that, and maybe influenced him in that way as well. But it's the most relatively down tempo of all the songs. It still doesn't hang about really rhythmically, but it's the relatively most ambient, isn't it? I would say. So compared to all the others, this is a kind of a change of tempo, and lyrically, it's kind of sinister. I can't say specifically what it's about, so I'll say it's just about kind of Jungian shadows, maybe the dark shadows in people's subconscious when they're trying to be in denial about stuff, and you know, you think you'll lament it, but I whisper in your ear. Maybe it's about aging, just getting older. It could be about bad health. It could be any kind of insecurities. You could read into it what you want specifically, but I think that's my meta narrative. It's the kind of like, yeah, that period where the autumnal thing, where summer's kind of over and you're starting to, you know, just have doubts about stuff and whatever that the cause of it may be.
So I would agree with that completely in the context of this interpretation. And I think there's a lot of merit to this interpretation. But again, I always go back to thinking, if you go too far down all these meta routes, you sometimes miss out on just the joy of the song. Beat the Clock is a really funny song about moving too fast through life and having, you know, and just trying to beat that clock. This is a song, a very sinister song, you know, on its surface, about someone who's kind of stalking someone, you know. There's different ways you can look at it. There's a psychological interpretation that's been discussed, but there's always like a kind of on the surface explanation for these songs. I think sometimes gets neglected when we get when I hear these highly meta interpretations. Take a song like Instant Weight Loss. We had a little discussion, a little small group that we had, and we came up with about four or five different interpretations of it. And I always thought it stood as a wonderful, funny little song about a guy who was trying to lose some weight to get a girl. You know, I thought that was funny enough. That was pretty hilarious. Yeah. But then, this and that, and, you know, all these other interpretations. I'm just making a play for just sometimes enjoying the songs for what they are.
Forest for the trees.
Well, I think the danger is if you start to impart any intent on the writer's part and you start to say, this is what...
That's a good way to put it.
You know? Yeah. But I think, certainly in the case of the stuff that I'm saying to you now, it's... These are just kind of themes, if you like. I prefer themes rather than concepts. So when I say it's autumnal, it's a mood. Yeah. That's the mood it conjures up. And you can put into words, you know, sort of, you know, like I say, you know, what would make that mood? none of it is intended as this is what the males meant. It's just more a case of, to me, I get a kind of like a, you've had your fun now, you know, things are starting to kind of ease up a bit mood. And that, you know, that I guess I'm just trying to, in my case, it's say what I get from it.
Yeah.
But I think the point would be that I would never say to people, this is what they mean.
It's no, and I wasn't saying that you were. I was just kind of, because I agree with you on this album. And I think one of the great things about the males is there's clearly layers and layers taking place in their music. And part of the game is interpreting it. And so I'm not in any way saying, you know, that you have it wrong. I think you have it right in this case. I'm just saying that one of the fun things about it is just, or one of the interesting things about it is if you take a song like this, it can have so many interpretations, including what you hear the first time you hear it. And I think maybe I'm getting at is that that's one of the great things about a record like this, is that there's just so many different ways that you can hear it.
Maybe also it's a case of different Sparks albums. And maybe this is a really interesting point, maybe, that you raise here. Maybe this is what Sparks themselves were feeling with these more studio-based albums, that it wasn't as discoverable, it wasn't just getting out on the road and playing. And so maybe they themselves were like, well, you know, this is real heavy concept stuff. It's like, they maybe had to do it and they had to kind of get it out of their system, or it just came together, just came that way. But I think you're right. I think there came a point for them almost immediately, certainly after Terminal Child, where we're like, you know, we want to do songs about Mickey Mouse, we want to play live. And yeah. Don't get me wrong, I love all that stuff as well. And say, I would listen to, say, Sparks in Outer Space a lot more with that mindset. So I think it's one of the things about Sparks is some of their stuff is really profound, and then other stuff is literally just almost this comedy sketch. And that's one of the things I love about them. You never quite know what you'll get. Or some might seem light, and then you're like, holy cow, wow, I never thought of that. Or you might think it's really deep, but it's just a joke. You never know.
Well, we're on the same page with you.
Yeah. So, you know, regarding the reading all kinds of weird theses into a lot of the songs, they started around this time or a few years after that in interviews. They would push back or demur or something against readings that aren't necessarily directly in the text. Like you can hear interviews or read interviews from both Ron and Russ who keep arguing some version of there's less going on than you might think there is. Sometimes, you know, it just means what you hear. Of course, you always got to take that with a grain of salt, too, because, you know how they like to take the piss out of interviewers.
But I think, I just think what I'm saying with regard to my voice is very much about the sound of the music. I mean, the lyrics that tell their own story, but it's sort of... if I can explain why I get that vibe from it. Reversed symbols, reversed sounds always sound creepy and sinister. The Beatles sort of, you know, did this.
Masking. Like Tomorrow Never Knows.
Yeah. So the very bed of my other voice, it's sort of unnerving. And that's just kind of a musical thing before you even get to... And the fact that it takes so long to even get to the lyrics... It's almost about 3 or 4 minutes before you get there. So it's a very unusual song for the album. You wouldn't even know it was Sparks necessarily till Russell starts singing. You might think it was like Yellow Magic Orchestra or someone, or even...
It is so different than the other songs on the album.
And it would definitely qualify more nowadays as what I call ambient music. Absolutely.
What did you call it?
Ambient.
Ambient. Yes. I'm glad you said that. Right. Because I get that from this as well. Ambient, or maybe some sort of like lighter kind of trance. But it has a hypnotic quality that the rest of the album doesn't really have. And it reminds me more of the Eno Berlin era Bowie albums, you know, Low and
Low and stuff.
It's more. I mean, there. I want to say contemplative, but there's a bit more going on than you know what would lend itself to just contemplation.
Well, this is the end. This is the end. Number one in heaven is what happens after. This is it. That maybe, other voice comes. That's
years. Yeah. Maybe you're right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Who is the other voice?
That's what I mean by autumnal. Yeah. It's kind of the end of an era sort of thing and faded. It's got a sort of a faded glory feel to it. You know, it's like a.
I wonder why they did that reverse cymbal sound. Because it's really, really arresting. Just a rhetorical question.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess Keith played it and they probably just stuck it through the tape backwards. But then to then put everything on top of that the right way around, it's, yeah, very strange. But it works brilliantly.
And it's the first time they've used a vocoder. Pretty sure.
That's true. Yeah. Wonder who sang for it wrong. Maybe.
Great question. That's a great question. I'd love to know. Don't know.
Georgia. And that gets us to the final song on the album.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. We're already there. Six.
Yeah. That's been an epic journey, actually. I've really enjoyed going through it like this. It seems to have reflected.
Now you say this is three songs in one. I always heard it as two songs in one.
I heard it as two songs in one as well. But okay,
what's the third?
Okay, well, again, you know, it's with a song called "The Number One Song in Heaven," you're sort of asking for people to go deep on something like that. It's that how many pop songs even talk about heaven? I mean, it's maybe right. Heaven is a place on earth and stuff, but you know, it's kind of a metaphysical subject for a song. So inherently, you know, you're talking about a topic that people base kind of world religions on. It's a you know, you can go in any way direction with this song or what it means. And again, I stress, I'm coming at this from the musical more than the lyrical perspective.
Well, I think that's so valuable because we all tend to focus so much on Ron's lyrics, and his songwriting is so amazing and so different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I love and hearing again, what you have to say. Yeah.
Well, I can't say that he intended this. It's not like I'm saying he sat there in the studio and said, "Hey, why don't we do this?" It's just what comes out. And I guess it's maybe subconscious. It's maybe this is the thing with kind of musical geniuses, that they don't consciously think about it, and it just sort of flows through them, and then we as listeners, we impart stuff from that. And you know, and I think Number One in Heaven, it's, you can argue exactly who did what. I mean, I've heard that Giorgio maybe played some of a melody on it, and fair enough. Conceptually though, I think you have to say thematically it's absolutely Ron and Russell, the Number One song in heaven, and I don't think anyone else could have done what they did, even with similar kind of music. In terms of the three songs then, so you've got the first bit is the kind of intro, the warm-up bit. If you think of, you know, we normally think of it as two songs, so the first half. Then you've got the switch with the drums. Yeah.
And those 16th notes are back. And
yeah.
All,
and this
all
is the bit that was the single. So in the UK, and I guess in most places, on a 7-inch single, you don't even have that first bit. So a lot of people would have never even heard that, even people who maybe bought the 7-inch. It's amazing. But
it just it saps all the drama out of the song when you don't have the A part, the first part. It's like if you were listening to A Day in the Life, but it was, you know, it was just the John part or the Paul part, whichever one comes next, whichever one is the second half.
I love the Beatles.
Woke up, fell out of bed. Yeah, it's like if the whole song were just that.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So that's the second half. But the kind of hidden third bit, or the secret third bit, in my opinion, and it's just an idea. It's, you know, it might or not be, but it's a nice idea. Is that the Gabriel plays it? Let's hear him play it. Is because if you think about it, they're telling you about the song in heaven, and then let's hear him play it. now you're actually hearing it. What are you hearing? What do you hear when you hear that middle bit? I mean, it's very random, isn't it? It's very... What's going on there?
I think random is a great word for that part. I've never quite figured that part out in the context of the song.
Yeah.
The song is like kind of like an infinity mirror, or like two mirrors facing each other in a way. Lyrically, you know, because it's, you can't escape the meta. Because it's a song, and it's a song about a song, and you know, and it's about dying and ascending to heaven, and then you have this visual of like being on an escalator or something when there's elevator/escalator music being piped in, and it happens to be the song, the one that you're listening to right now, and it just sort of becomes like a funhouse mirror or an Ouroboros, which I think that's Ron lyrically at his best, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Maybe I'd just go for that kind of thing.
No, definitely. I mean, and it said, you thinking about this whole thing in terms of their own career, they're kind of rebirthing their own career at this point. They're literally rebuilding their own career. So they're, as Paul might say, they're telling you what they're doing while they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the number one song in heaven, I think, is the pinnacle of all this work with electronics, all the experimentation they've been doing. And I mean, I don't know if they did it last, you know, if they actually did the songs in the order that we hear them, or it's kind of weird to think that they recorded this one first and then did tryouts, isn't it? It sort of feels like, it feels like they did them in the order you hear them, but I don't know. But it feels like that way. It feels like this would have been the absolute, you know, we've learned all these tricks. We know how to use a vocoder. We know how to use weird drum noises. We know how to use kind of tempo changes. This is like the kind of tour de force.
That's a great, great point. That's true. All of the lessons that they had learned working on this album come for an encore or a finale with this song. Yeah, I like that.
And you kind of hinted at something when in our earlier communications that when it breaks out from the disco sound at the beginning of the album, it's almost signaling the end of disco. It's like they're going right back to their rock roots, and basically rock and roll, not rock and roll, but rock roots. And that's a wonderful way to put it.
And it's this new style of dance music that would, you know, in the '80s, like I say, the new wave, the new electronic stuff, more angular, more kind of less the sort of, you know, string sections and orchestras and stuff, and more kind of synths and the funny thing is it would take Terminal Jive to kind of bring guitars into that mix where it's not conventional rock, but it's got guitars again. I think they just had to have
the guitars
in maybe it was in Terminal Jive.
Oh, Terminal Jive, right.
Terminal
right.
Jive, yeah.
So I guess I'd say, they, you know, ultimately that guitars would come back into this sound, but they just had to have... Yeah, maybe it was more guitarists than guitars that they had a problem with. They just think of guitarists.
Yeah, could be. But, yeah, I think that impulse was kind of floating around that time and the late 70s, I think there was sort of a sense that there was this technological transition happening and rock music is now 25 years old. It, like David Bowie said, rock and roll is a toothless old grandmother. So it's crazy to think here we are now 45 or so years later and rock music is still very much alive and kicking, although not hitting the charts like it once did.
Yeah.
No, but it's out there.
Yeah.
It's out there. You have to look a little harder for it, but it's there.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm glad you said what you said, Monty, about returning to rock roots or something, or sounding more like a rock band, because that part, that second half of the song, seems to sort of showcase what you can do with electronic music, but still keeping in some of the some of the structure or some of the aesthetics of rock, and that, like the beat and sort of like the bass line. And I guess just like the sonic attack of that sounds more rock and roll.
The attitude, isn't it? And it's the kind of this is the kind of spirit and the oomph in a way. Kind of there was a couple of things I was going to say in terms of its influence. Number one, obviously, I think this is another really good example of Keith Forsey sort of learning what he would then go on to do with people like Billy Idol and Simple Minds in the 80s. They've said it on interview that Joy Division were totally inspired by this song, particularly the drums, as it's Stephen Morris, the drummer from New Order, pretty much copied the second half drum sound for Love and Tears of Art. So compare and contrast.
Oh, really?
So just goes to, I think it was that.
Stephen Morris said that Lovell Terrace Apart, he was inspired by this.
He said they were listening to Frank Sinatra and Number One in Heaven at the time they recorded it. They were the two albums that
That's a weird party.
Yeah. But I mean, Sparks, New Order, you know, I think, and not just New Order, Depeche Mode, Duran Duran, all these big 80s bands, Human League, Flock of Seagulls, Tears to Fears, it all really, comes from that meeting of electronics and rock, I think.
The chord progression is also, in both of those halves, the rising, this lifting kind of chord progression it gives the sensation of ascending, which, you know, and maybe that's what came first, and maybe that sort of, you know, inspired, you know, Ron to think, oh, it's like going up to heaven and whatever. But I think that's, for me, that's one of the things that makes this song so so emotionally resonant.
I introduced my dad to Sparks. He got into them. And I think there's a kind of queen element in this as well. Certainly the first section, maybe. I think it could almost pass for Queen or vice versa.
How do you mean? I'm curious. I'm a Queen fan myself.
Things like Radio Gaga and the kind of multi-track vocals. You could almost imagine.
Which came out 5 years after this. So you could make a case for Queen being informed by this song with Radio Gaga.
They did was it Hot Space with Mac as well. So there's a bit of and of course they opened the Sparks way back. I think there's quite a lot of kind of overlap between the two bands. I think their paths crossed a fair few times.
Yeah, Monty's heard a few of my mini theories about Sparks and Queen. Paths have crossed many times.
Yes.
One thing we don't really talk about very much on our podcast, and I don't really think your show either, Monty, are the music videos. This is 2 years before MTV came out. Of course, you know, you had Top of the Pops and all that sort of stuff. But out of the 6 songs on this album, I think 4 have music videos. Like this that's another thing that kind of makes this album feel like the start of something new, that they're paying more attention to the visual thing and they're doing videos. Do you have any like opinions on the videos? I mean, they're all different in their own way.
Well, you see, I'm trying to imagine what it must have actually been like being Sparks at this time. So, you know, they've essentially always been a kind of live based band, and then for the last few years they've not really been playing live. So, you know, yes, you do the recording, but then what do you do after that? Once you've done this record and you can't play live, and they couldn't play live, so what do you do? I mean, and I can imagine this is maybe why one of the reasons they went back to playing live again was it's kind of boring just being in a studio all day and maybe have to do awful TV shows and this and that. And I guess the videos was a way they could kind of explore their creativity instead of playing live. So in other words, you know, instead of just doing it, playing gigs, get a video out there and people could see it that way. I think as a result.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
They really capitalized.
They couldn't tour for, I think this was the first time when they really couldn't tour these songs. So it makes sense that they would, you know, want to exploit, you know, this this novel, you know, way of presenting your music. And they've always been a visually oriented band.
Yes.
From day one. And so, and you know, they made a few music videos before this. I don't even think they called them music videos, you know, those days, so like promotional clips, I guess.
Yeah.
But I think that was kind of kismet. I think it was really, really helpful for them, and it came at just the right time. They were getting their, you know, they're dipping their toes into the water of being sort of video, you know, videos. This is 2 years before, or 1 year, I think, before video is going to kill the radio star. And I wonder if they sort of saw that approaching, but it's just, it's, I don't know if I have like a specific point that I want to make, but the videos are just, they bring a whole new element to the way they showcase themselves and get their music across. And I frankly, I just wish they had done more of it. And, you know, for the decade or so after this, I mean, you would have one or two videos per album, but I guess it was also kind of prohibitively expensive at that time too. Like if you're going to shoot on film.
Yeah, I mean, it's the one for Tryouts looks really lavish. It looks like something a sci-fi thing or something, even though it's got nothing to do with lyrics.
I know. Like reminded me of American Werewolf in London.
Exactly. It was about the same time. And of course, a good 4 years before Thriller, so, you know, ahead of a curve again. But yeah, it's 80s. It's the difference between 70s disco. You don't think of videos of disco music. You think of videos of 80s and beyond, you know. So it's just another post-disco, disco's afterlife, or, you know, something new.
You can sort of see this as, you know, one of the first 80s pop records or 80s dance records. And kind of the same way that you could imagine the first Nine Inch Nails album, Pretty Hate Machine, as being a 90s record, even though it came out in 1989. But it's such a harbinger for what's just around the corner.
And I think maybe that's why Number One in Heaven was critically... I've really seen some of the reviews, and they're really scathing. Mm-hmm. And I just think they didn't... There was nowhere to put this album. It didn't fit in anywhere at the time. And, you know, there was no category for this sort of stuff. I guess it was just lumped in with disco, but it's as we've discussed, there's so much more to this than just normal disco. It's dance, or it's whatever it is. It's not disco, or it's not just disco.
Right. Yeah, I think a lot of those more negative reviews that were contemporaneous when the album came out, they were kind of slotting Sparks into that same category of like dinosaur rock and roll bands who are bereft of ideas. So what the hell, let's do disco. Hey, the Stones did it. Rod Stewart did it. You know? Who else was doing it that you wouldn't expect? You know, probably, Paul Anka, who knows? But there wasn't really the context to explain, you know, what this is and what they were doing, because it just hadn't really happened yet. Unless you count Kraftwerk or Yellow Magic Orchestra, and that's actually something I wanted to talk about earlier with Monty here, but we can still get into it. Sorry, I was just going all over the place there.
Well, I mean, in terms of how it relates to the other electronic stuff of that era, I've got to say, it's not like my living memory, so this is all kind of research. I wasn't there at the time. Well, I was very young, but way too young to sort of know what was going on. So this is all just kind of looking at dates, looking at release dates and saying, well,
yeah,
time-wise, this came before that. So this was recorded 78. I think Kraftwerk, The Man Machine, was that 78?
Yeah, Man Machine was 78, and Trans Europe Express was 77.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you compare it to, say, Trans Europe Express, I love Kraftwerk, and, you know, nothing I say is any disrespect. But it's a lot more sort of clunky sounding in a way. It's not like a full band. It's
right.
I mean, that's the Kraftwerk sound. Is it? It's very analog electronics, 70s electronics. But Number One in Heaven, something else. It's fully developed pop rock dance songs with electronic, you know, based on electronics. But it's so much. It's more rounded in a way.
Yeah,
the drums and the vocals, and the songwriting itself.
I mean, I give Kraftwerk, whom I love also, and an enormous amount of credit for putting the pieces of this aesthetic together. You know,
yes,
jettison all the normal human instruments and let it all be synthesizers and a drum machine, but make them pop songs. And
yes,
they had figured out how to do that pretty well by like 75 or so, but unlike Number One in Heaven, it was there's a coldness, right? There's a very, you know, stereotypical sort of German or you know, Teutonic coldness to it, and it doesn't have any of the fun, you know, the hedonism of you know, rock, or I guess even disco.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's almost like pure unadulterated electronica, whereas with Sparks, they've always been a mix and match sort of band. So when they do electronica, it's not in a vacuum in the same way. It's sort of got all these other influences. I mean, let's not forget, literally the year before, they were doing Beach Boys. pastiches. I actually really like Introducing Sparks as an album in its own right. And it's, you know, for what it is, it's
I like
great
it.
Songs, but it's what does it say that they went from that to Number One in Heaven? But you know, you can't, and before that, obviously, Big Beat. So they're not just pure electronica, they're electronica with all this other stuff that's going in there as well. It's a real melting pot,
right? Yeah, I think that's, if nothing else, is what makes this a different beast. Is that they're putting these conflicting aesthetics together, and from the clash of context, that's where you get sort of this element of, I don't know, danger.
Well, I think it's different. one of the best things of, you know, the best bands is to take opposing things, or things that really shouldn't go together, but in the wrong hands don't go together, but in the right hands you can make something really amazing out of it. And I think that's always been the Sparks way. And to put Number One in Heaven in context with their other stuff, I mean, it works on the electronic level, but then if you see it as just another Sparks album, it works on that level as well. You know, it's part of their long-term journey. It's Ron's songwriting, playing, Russell's amazing singing. I mean, there's so much else I could say about Number One in Heaven, but I guess there's other perspectives, and I'm interested to hear them. So when it comes to the lyrics, I would definitely sort of listen to what people like Paul have to say. I think, you know, let's listen to it on a sound or, you know, kind of audio level, and let's listen to what the synths and the drum machines, or drums, if not drum machines, let's listen to what they're telling us as well. And it goes with the words. It doesn't contradict it. You know, there's a real match between the lyrics and the sounds that are going underneath them. And I think that must have taken real skill in those days. You know, again, it all comes back to how they did this. You know, if you think of songwriting, you might have a bit of an idea for a song. You might have a verse, but you might not be able to work out how it gets to the middle eight or how it gets to the chorus. It's hard enough to do that with just a piano or a guitar. How, how did they work out? Right, okay, tryouts, we're going to go from this section to this section.
Yeah.
You had a wrong note. How did you replay it? How did you
That's a great question. I know that Ron habitually, at least up until this album, would write out his songs with an acoustic guitar. So right. He would work out the chords and, you know, and the key and all that sort of stuff with just a simple rhythm guitar to guide him. And, you know, he would record demos. They did this for in preparation for recording a bunch of their albums. That would be like sort of the demo of the demo. So I would love to know how he started working on these. Like, how does a song like Beat the Clock lend itself to strumming a campfire guitar? I just don't see it, you know?
And I wonder, maybe with that song, maybe he wrote the lyrics first and then built the music around that. But I wonder if maybe
I could see that.
Some of the other songs, the music came first and then they put the words to that. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, you know, it could be that they were just playing around with random noises and they came up with sort of accidentally came up with stuff and thought, oh, we could write a song around that. Which, you know, there's so many questions I'd love to know. And then that brings us on to Noel and Terminal Jive and how different were their modus operandi to them. How, you know, they'd worked with Giorgio on Number One in Heaven. So how did they then apply that on their own with the Noel?
There you go.
Know, because, I mean, what equipment there, they use.
There's our segue. Do you have another 2 hours? I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Yeah, once again, Adam, it's been such a pleasure having you on. Going to have you back on, of course. I would really like to have you back on for Gratuitous Sax. We get to that for sure. Which, you know, hopefully that will happen before 2030. I haven't been very prolific lately.
Well, it's really nice to talk because I really have enjoyed your shows and just to put some context of the reach of what you do. So for my day job, I drive a lot, an awful lot. I mean, I can be driving like 200 miles a day. So, you know, I listen to a lot of music, but I listen to podcasts and just to really have a deep dive and to listen to one of your shows or I think is it Angst? You did three shows? You got three?
We did four. Unbelievably, we did four for Angst, yeah.
It's just great. It's really good to listen in the car. And you can really just zone into it. And it's really good. And then obviously Monty's stuff, it's more with the video and you can sit and watch out at home. So it's just a really good pull stuff. And, you know, there's other stuff. And I think in some ways now's the best time to be a Sparks fan because there's so much analysis of this stuff now.
Yeah.
And back, just to maybe close this off, but just to take people back to what it was like being a Sparks fan. In 1994, I think 1994 was the first year I even heard of the internet. I don't think I had it myself then. I think 1995 was the first year I started seeing Sparks online, and that was the first way I started to really understand their back catalogue. But if you think back to before that, how on earth were you supposed to get hold of Sparks' old albums?
It's mind-boggling. Insane. Yeah, when I hear from longtime fans that they didn't even know that Terminal Jive existed for decades, because if something wasn't printed in your territory, in your country, and if you weren't, you know, getting a weekly newsletter or anything like that, there was just no way to know. There was no way to know what your band was doing. And it's mind-boggling. You take for granted, you know, certain changes in society, and you wonder how did we live?
how did we
love?
But when you see all the Sparks videos on YouTube, I think it makes it a lot easier to kind of to see the totality, to really get an overview of everything they've done, and you know. All right, maybe got a little older and a little wrinklier, but not a lot, really.
Yeah.
Compared to a lot of people, they're remarkably unchanging, apart from Ron's hair during the number one in heaven period. I think it's about the most significant change ever, really, and sort of slight change to his moustache sometime in the 80s. But really, yeah, visually, they've not changed their fundamentals ever, really, have they? At heart.
Yeah, they've been remarkably consistent in a lot of ways. And I just, if you were, if you had enough self-control and wherewithal and dedication to completely forsake alcohol or drugs or, anything attached to the sex, drugs, and rock and roll lifestyle. Not to say that, they didn't have ladies. I know they did, but the sex and or rather the drugs part, which they very, very famously are and always have been straight edge, which I probably which I would imagine has a lot to do with how well preserved they are today.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, but equally, their music can, well, it can be sort of psychedelic, if you like, or hallucinogenic in places, if not. So they're out there naturally, in a way. It's like the classic case of they don't need to kind of, take loads of drugs just to kind of be very inventive. I mean, it's just natural creative mind, I suppose. And, they've just got that oozing out of them, and I guess they always have done. And yeah, long may they continue, really.
Yeah. Agreed. Excellent. Adam. Again, it's been a great pleasure, and can't wait to have you back on again. And a couple of weeks from now, when you are listening to podcasts as you're driving, you will probably be listening to your own voice. So be prepared for that.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you. And thanks to Monty, obviously, for fixing it all up. But yeah,
thank you so much. And
you got it, man.
Talk to you guys.
Yeah. It's been a huge pleasure. Cheers.